stunning phone call this weekend, first obtained by the Washington Post, President Trump pressures Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, to find enough votes to overturn President-elect Joe Biden's win.
The White House had tried to make this call happen, the operator telling us 18 times, and actually Saturday was the first time that these two men ever connected over the phone.
Hey, Brad, it's me. I'm wondering if you would do a little crime, recalculate if you don't mind, just 11,780 votes you need to find. I just called to save ego. I just called to kill democracy. I just called to say I'm desperate, and I mean it from the bottom where my heart should be.
Well done, Stephen Colbert and crew.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Well, that's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't. It never is.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. In Rochester, New York on WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV. Out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. In Concord, New Hampshire on WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX. Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for you, even in 2021. On the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Deprogrammed Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk, Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us with 15 days now until Inauguration Day. This countdown, Desi Doyen, has gone on forever, it seems.
It does.
Another way to look at it, of course, that I prefer to look at it, just 15 days left in the Donald Trump presidency. That's it, 15 days. We can make that. We can all make that, right?
Yes, 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 we can.
At least in theory. That is, of course, based on what happens Wednesday in Congress when Joe Biden's decisive, clear, definite, certain Electoral College victory over Donald Trump will finally be affirmed or not, say it with me, or not by Congress. I think it will, however, but we'll see. And today, as we go to air, it's the final day for Georgians to cast their votes in the state's two ongoing U.S. Senate runoff elections, which will determine control of the U.S. Senate, at least in theory, because I'm sure we'll have a very clear result and nothing to worry about on Wednesday. So, yes, it is a busy and strange and insane week. So welcome back to the Bradcast. Voters experienced few lines reportedly in Georgia on Tuesday morning. Turnout appeared to be lower than on Election Day in the presidential election in Georgia, according to Gabriel Sterling, the state's voting system manager. Well, that could be good news for Democrats, the lower turnout on Election Day, as during the general election in November, early and mail-in ballots leaned heavily towards Democrats, and Election Day voting was heavier for Republicans following the false instructions given by Donald Trump that mail-in voting was a scam. Average wait times were said to be between 1 and 5 minutes in most areas, according to Sterling, with the longest waits reaching 30 minutes in Cobb and DeKalb counties, Democratic areas, naturally, in the metro Atlanta area. According to some sources that I have heard from, however, on the ground in Atlanta today, they are receiving reports that lines are actually longer than in the general election.
Really?
Yes, though I believe that's coming out of, again, the Atlanta area, which, as much as I hate to say it, long lines may be good news for Democrats in the Democratic-leaning areas. But nearly 3.1 million Georgians have already voted early or returned absentee ballots before Tuesday morning, with hundreds of thousands more expected to show up throughout the day on Tuesday. About 988,000 people voted on Election Day on November 3rd. But turnout as of mid-afternoon Tuesday was reportedly lower based on reports of short waits, according to Sterling. Of course, the ballot itself is much shorter these runoffs.
That's
right?
True. So people will spend less time as they slog through the ballot on the voting machine, which limits the number of people that can vote at a single time.
Correct. There are only two Senate races and one Public Service Commission race on the ballot. So time spent voting and the length of the lines, well, may or may not tell us much. In fact, Sterling conceded election officials have no way of knowing actual turnout numbers until the ballots are, you know, counted. There were some issues with the terrible new $300 million unverifiable Dominion touchscreen voting systems forced on the state for the first time in 2020 by the Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, a man who has become a bit more famous in recent days for some reason, known now to more than just people who happen to listen to the broadcast. There were some printer and scanner jams reported, though they were said to have been quickly corrected by midday. The most significant problems occurred in Columbia County, where voters in some precincts had to fill out emergency paper ballots because of problems with the voting equipment. I will hope that there were plenty of emergency paper ballots to cover that gap in Columbia County, which, by the way, is a very Republican-leaning county. According to the Secretary of State's office, a number of keys that start up the paper ballot scanners were programmed incorrectly. In addition, a few poll worker cards were programmed incorrectly, which meant that some poll workers were unable to start the touchscreen voting machines that are used for computer-marked paper ballot voting in Georgia on Election Day. As regular listeners to the broadcast over the past several years probably know by now, probably don't need me to explain, probably don't want me to explain, but Georgia now forces voters at the polls on Election Day and in early in-person voting as well to vote on these new Rube Goldberg computer systems, which include about five different computers just to cast and count one single vote. There's a touchscreen check-in, computerized poll book, that uses another device to create a voter card that is then placed into the computer touchscreen voting system, where the voter selects candidates on the screen before a ballot summary is printed by another device printed out on a piece of paper, which is then taken to yet another computer to be optically scanned. That was the one that the keys seemed to be misprogrammed in Columbia County to start the optical scan systems. The good news there is even if they can't get the optical scan systems going, at least people can vote. And they can put those into a secure box and tally them later. But they're optically scanned when things are working correctly. They are scanned either correctly or incorrectly. There is actually no way of knowing without a hand count of those paper ballot summary pages, though it's almost impossible to know if the paper that is printed by the computer actually reflects the intent of the voter, since most voters don't check their printouts, which is just one of the reasons why we call for hand-marked paper ballots in elections. And by the way, of those who do check their computer-marked printouts, recent studies find that as many as 93% of them do not notice when the computer has actually flipped one of their votes. Now, hopefully, in this case, in Georgia, in these Senate runoffs with such a short ballot, any such erroneous printout for any reason, like a programming mistake or purposeful manipulation, if it were to happen, anything like that would be noticed by the voters, one would hope, because there is only three races on most of the ballots across the state. So hopefully the voters would notice if the computer in this case misprinted. But who knows? There's no way to know if they noticed it or not before they cast it into the computer optical scan system for one single vote. Yes, it is an insane way to run an election, as demonstrated by the ease at which they were able to simply move to emergency hand-marked paper ballots when the touchscreen voting systems or the electronic poll books, when either of them failed, as occurred in some locations on Tuesday. The Secretary of State's office said the correct keys and voter cards in Columbia were delivered to the relevant precincts with a law enforcement escort, and the issue was resolved by 10 a.m.
Sorry, all you voters who showed up before 10.
Yep. Hopefully, during those hours, voters at least were allowed to vote on paper and not turned away, but who knows? Rob Pitts, the county commissioner in the largest Atlanta county, that would be Fulton County, told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that he is visiting 50 precincts throughout the county today to see how things are going. He says there haven't been any issues at all. He said, we're prepared to give Fulton County another A+. Of course, he's county commissioner in Fulton, so take that for what it's worth. And I suspect Donald Trump has not given an A+ to Fulton County, even though, as far as I can tell, they actually deserve one for a change after the November elections. Pitts did not provide an estimate for when the results might come out in Fulton, but he did say that things will move pretty quickly after the absentee ballots start being counted at 7 p.m. when polls close on Tuesday across the state. If the general election in November is any indication, it may take a few days before we know who actually won in either of these Senate races, though with just two or three candidates on the ballot and a presumably smaller turnout than in the general, we may have an idea of who won earlier than we did in November. That would be nice. It may come down to how close the races are, however, and for the moment, as we go to air, they are expected to be very, very close. We'll talk to my guest about that momentarily. In any event, if the tight presidential race in Georgia, which was won by about 12,000 votes by Joe Biden, is any indication, these races could also be tight. Then again, they might not be. In short, at this hour, nobody knows nothing.
Well, I can make a prediction.
Oh, would you like to?
I would like to make a prediction.
All right, what's your prediction?
If the Democrats win, then yeah, Republicans will sue to hell and heaven above to make sure that none of those races are certified or those people are seated.
Yeah.
And if the Republicans win those races, it will be a perfect election.
Perfect election. You're really going out on a limb there, Desi Doyen, and I hope you can back that up. Anyway, for the most part right now, people appear able to vote, which is what I most care about at this moment. No matter who they are, no matter who they are voting for, at least reportedly, they are able to vote. As usual, a reminder that problems with the voting systems often do not come to light until days after the elections or longer. In the case of the presidential election, partisan Republicans, sometimes they don't present their phony information about election problems until weeks later. So the politics here, of course, could not be more important, despite my interest in making sure that everyone who wants to vote legally is allowed to vote. But with partisan control of the Senate hanging in the balance here, and with Donald Trump making things as confusing as possible for his supporters, describing the Senate runoffs over the weekend, over this past weekend, as, quote, illegal. He tweeted that these runoffs are illegal. Just a day before he held a rally in Dalton, Georgia, before a crowd of about 2,000 largely maskless supporters, telling everyone that they should vote. Even, by the way, maskless as Georgia is going through its worst COVID-19 surge on record. And there he was, making things worse, holding another super spreader event, telling people they should absolutely, definitely vote. The day after, he told them that the election is illegal and whatever. He, according to the New York Times, he used the campaign rally on the eve of these Senate runoffs to once again vent his debunked grievances about the outcome of November's presidential election as he continued his assault on the peaceful transfer of power, as the Times reports it, in the appearance that was supposed to be to bolster the fortunes of two Republican candidates, Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. Trump instead turned the nearly 90-minute rally into a rambling lecture filled with conspiracy theories, rumors, unproven assertions, and personal attacks on Democrats, the news media, and Georgia's Republican officials. Well, of course, that's what the people paid for. He said just after taking the stage, quote, "There's no way we lost Georgia. I've had two elections. I've won both of them. It's amazing," he said. He should have said it's unbelievable. Anyway, moments later, after briefly mentioning the two Republican senators, he shifted back to his own losing election, saying, quote, "They're not going to take this White House. We're going to fight like hell, I'll tell you right now. They are not going to take this White House." Trump attacked the U.S. Supreme Court for refusing to hear the Texas lawsuit that tried to invalidate voting in four states. He called on Vice President Pence to somehow use his ceremonial role presiding over the electoral vote count in Congress on Wednesday to somehow deliver a win to Donald Trump. Right now, no one knows what Mike Pence is or isn't going to do. Trump offered a vague threat to Pence that if he didn't somehow use his position as president of the Senate to help him steal the election on Wednesday at that joint session of Congress, which is only meant to affirm the Electoral College votes already certified by all 50 states, showing that Trump lost to Joe Biden by a decisive 306 to 232 electoral vote margin. If Pence did not step up somehow, Donald Trump said he would not like him nearly as much anymore. Nonetheless, after days of refusing to answer questions about it, Republican incumbent Senator Kelly Loeffler on Monday announced her plan to object to the Electoral College certification process this week that will ratify President-elect Biden's victory. In a statement on Monday, Loeffler said she shares the, quote, "real concerns of the way in which the November presidential election was conducted," before signaling her intent to challenge the electoral votes that cemented Biden's victory. Mind you, Loeffler is only in the runoffs thanks to the November election, which she now has real concerns about. Loeffler also declared her loyalty to President Trump, who's come under fire following the leak of his unhinged phone call pressuring Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to, quote, "find votes to overturn the battleground state's election results." Loeffler said the American people deserve a platform in Congress permitted under the Constitution to have election issues presented so that they can be addressed. She said, "That's why on January 6th, I will vote to give President Trump and the American people the fair hearing they deserve and support the objection to the Electoral College certification process." Loeffler's statement comes a day after she sidestepped a question from Fox News anchor Bret Baier about whether she plans to join some of her Republican colleagues in challenging the Electoral College vote this week. Loeffler apparently will be able to participate in that joint session on Wednesday because she was actually appointed as senator to fill a vacancy. And her runoff against Democrat Raphael Warnock is actually a special election. So until that election is certified, it seems, Loeffler is able to continue serving. Not so, however, for Georgia's other incumbent Republican senator, David Perdue, who is running against Democrat John Ossoff. That, however, did not keep Perdue from misleading his constituents about all of this when he was pressed by a reporter on the ground over the holidays, as the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported at the time. Perdue's camp had said that he cannot formally lodge a challenge when Congress meets on January 6 because his term ends on January 3. That's 2 days before the runoff, and he cannot participate in Senate business until the results are certified. But he was apparently leading crowds at his rallies for the past several weeks to believe otherwise, according to progressive journalist and muckraker after my heart, Lauren Windsor, who retweeted that Perdue told her he would, quote, keep fighting for Donald Trump and, yes, challenge the Electoral College on January 6. That tweet from Windsor earned a retweet by Donald Trump, along with the message, which called Perdue a, quote, great guy and a patriot, and thanked Windsor for her tweet. Members of Perdue's campaign then retweeted Donald Trump's retweet, even though they know he cannot vote in Congress on Wednesday. Apparently, lack of interest in facts and reality runs deep on the GOP bench these days, as well as in the Perdue campaign. Given the chance to clarify publicly that Perdue will not be in place to challenge the election results, the Republicans' campaign declined to comment to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Windsor, as the AJC notes, is no diehard Perdue fan. She's, in fact, a left-leaning operative. Operative, they call her, who posts an online political show called The Undercurrent, and she makes no attempt at hiding her affiliation. She tweeted back at Trump after the retweet, quote, please follow me for continuing coverage exposing these GOP traitors for what they are, threats to democracy and the rule of law. In fact, Lauren Windsor, who has been bird-dogging Loeffler and Perdue for weeks now in Georgia, is the executive director of American Family Voices and the executive producer of the grassroots political web show The Undercurrent. Don't know if that makes her an operative or not. The show focuses largely on money in politics, corruption, Wall Street reform, and climate change. She's broken a whole bunch of major stories on the Koch brothers and their donor retreats, including releasing the audio from one of those retreats back in 2014, which really earned my love for Lauren after I had done similar some years earlier in 2010 from the Koch retreat in Colorado. She's also broken stories on the American Legislative Exchange Council and the right-wing espionage outfit Project Veritas. That's the James O'Keefe political hoax group, about whom we've also reported a thing or two over the years. And she joins me now from Georgia, where she has been on the ground for some time, dogging both Loeffler and Perdue for the past several weeks. Oh, Lauren Windsor, great to have you on the broadcast today.
Thanks, Brad. Happy to be here.
Good to have you. How long have you been in Georgia? You keep showing up everywhere from out here in Los Angeles, breaking stories on Perdue and the new Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville, his suggestion initially that he would challenge the electoral vote on Wednesday. How long have you been out there?
We got here on December 1st.
Uh-huh.
So just over a month.
I gotcha. And now Perdue, as I understand it, is still in quarantine on Election Day, as he has been since last week, due to contact apparently with someone with COVID. You also told me a day or two ago that you were being tested. Don't know if it's because of your contact with him or you weren't feeling well. How are you doing today, Lauren?
Doing great. Thanks for asking. My videographer, Peter James Callahan, had become symptomatic, and so We were concerned that, you know, his fever could be COVID, mm-hmm. but we went to get a rapid test and tested negative. So,
that's,
you know, very thankful for that.
Yeah, that's good news so far. Now, you or your cameraman weren't the ones that Purdue came in contact with that he had to go into quarantine about, because that would make you an operative, Lauren, if that was you making him sick.
We certainly aren't trying to infect anyone. We're just trying to report. But, you know, whether or not you want to call me operative is, I guess, based on your own assessment of my work. I've been called many things, from activist to muckraker mm-hmm. to operative. I wear a lot of different hats, but, you know, I'm a progressive political consultant mm-hmm. with a lot of different projects. So.
Yep, you do. You have a lot, indeed. Now, Loeffler and Perdue are both among the wealthiest members of the Senate. And I know one of the reasons you went to Georgia was to report on that fact. In fact, Loeffler's husband, I think, literally owns the New York Stock Exchange. Do I have that right? Am I right about that?
Yes. It's called ICE, mm-hmm. the Intercontinental Exchange, which, you know, has a number of entities that they control.
Mm-hmm.
But she's the richest member of Congress. I believe $800 million is their wealth.
Oh, man. Now, you've been, as I said, you know, tracking both of them over the past several weeks and trying to press them on their stock trades during the COVID crisis, with each of them reportedly making huge purchases and or sales to make money, allegedly, on the crisis. Have they been willing to answer any of your questions about that in recent weeks, Lauren?
No, I did ask Loeffler at two different rallies, one of which there's a video that you can see either on the Undercurrent on Facebook or at mm-hmm. LA Windsor on Twitter. But the Loeffler video, in it, I approach her and ask her specifically about why she didn't warn Georgians about the risks of COVID, the severity of it, when she was dumping stock.
Mm-hmm.
And her staffer moved in. She kind of gives a thumbs up to my cameraman mm-hmm. and doesn't say anything and moves on to the next person as her staffer pushes me out of the way.
Right. Yeah.
There was that. We had another video where the next time I was spotted, I was made by staffers, and so they kept me out of the event. But Pete was able to get in, and so Pete asked her questions, and you know, this was about the relief checks,
uh-huh.
and she said that she claimed that she was fighting Mitch McConnell, but then in the same breath, like, you know, like talking out of both sides of her face, she said that she's on the same bill as McConnell. She's like, oh, I'm on Mitch's bill, I'm working with Mitch. You know, it's just that Nancy is trying to raise the eligibility to $300,000, and we believe that this needs to be targeted, mm-hmm. targeted relief. The problem with that statement is that, and I've talked to many people about this, both like senior journalists at like the Washington Post and the Intercept, but also you know, people within the party, of like, is that true that the House raised eligibility? And it's actually not. So the bill that was passed and signed into law by Trump for mm-hmm. the $600 check,
yeah.
the only difference between that and the new bill passed by the House for mm-hmm. the $2,000 check
right.
is the amount of the check. They didn't mess with the eligibility whatsoever.
Right.
So it is totally disingenuous well, for her to say. Yeah. It's just an outright lie.
Well, yeah, it is, especially since she also... I think both her and Perdue voted for those $600 checks. They supported those. They supported Mitch McConnell, who was trying to make sure it did not go above $600. But then, didn't they both come out for the $2,000 payments eventually?
Yes, they both came out. This is what was, they're trying to have it both ways. And this was, you know, a similarity with the piece that you already quoted from mm-hmm. Bluestein, mm-hmm. Greg Bluestein at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Yeah.
The whole idea that they reported on this in the first place is like they're trying to have it both ways with regards to, you know, supporting the Electoral College Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're trying to have it both ways with, you know, supporting the $2,000 relief checks. It's like, we'll tell you that's what we want, but we're actually going to work with McConnell to make sure it can't happen. You know, the bill that McConnell put forward was not one that was, like, put forward in earnest. It was a poison pill bill meant to kill the effort entirely.
Right.
So, you know.
Do you
think the average...
No. Well, I was going to say, do you have a sense from the voters in Georgia, do they understand how wealthy that both of these Republican senators are, while the Republican Party is sort of pretending to be a populist party of late? Do they know the truth about those two senators, and are they buying any? I mean, there are so many mixed messages that are being sent about the checks, about the November election, Donald Trump going back and forth. Do you get any sense of what sense the Republican voters are making of this on the ground at this point?
Well, so, all the events that we've been covering have been, Republican rallies. And I haven't had in-depth conversations with the voters themselves, mm-hmm. but the way that they respond to the sort of populist rhetoric put forth by Loeffler and Perdue, they eat it up. I mean, they're supporting it. The lines by Loeffler talking about having, known hard work from growing up on a farm really kind of glosses over the fact that, like, she wasn't, she came from a rich farm family and, mm-hmm. Went to college from selling property that she got as an inheritance. So,
well, who hasn't, Lauren? Yeah.
Right. I'm not sure how many people can, say that it wasn't exactly a rags to riches story for Kelly Loeffler. It was more of a riches to riches story.
Right.
Maybe she wasn't nearly a billionaire mm-hmm. when she grew up, but she certainly had a big family farm with mm-hmm. enough property that her inheritance was fairly substantial. But they try to seem women and men of the people, wearing, you see Loeffler out at campaign events and she almost always has on plaid or a tablecloth checkered shirt,
right.
or camouflage hats. I mean, she always looks like she's about to go hunting.
Right.
And David Perdue, at many of these events, is wearing a denim suit. He's wearing mm-hmm. pair of jeans with a jean jacket. He's down home. Meanwhile, this guy owns a home within a gated community. That's within a gated community. you can't even get on to Sea Island unless you're a member, and then once you're part of that sort of Tony crowd on Sea Island, you have to be even wealthier and more exclusive in order to get into the area where he actually lives. And I was able to get onto Sea Island to go try to see scope out his house, and from the island itself you can't see it. You can't get back there unless someone who's a member of the golf club.
Mm. Are they, Lauren, are you finding that, and you're going to their rallies, are they wearing masks at those rallies? Because they certainly weren't when at Trump's rally on Monday night. Are they wearing masks at the rallies that you go to? And does that concern you when they aren't?
Well, so, yes, it concerns me when they aren't. A lot of the people that are there, obviously, in the crowd, aren't wearing them. Loeffler and Perdue themselves, though, are wearing the masks until they come up to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So while they're waiting, talking to voters or just waiting while other people are speaking, they'll be wearing their masks and they'll take it off. When they're going through any of the lines of voters, to meet folks, shake hands, mm-hmm. take pictures, that sort of thing, they're always masked from what I've seen. So, they clearly think that COVID is enough of a risk that they're trying to take some precautions to protect themselves physically, but then clearly also financially from their stock sales.
One or two quick questions for you before I let you go, Lauren. I know you cover the GOP hoaxer James O'Keefe and his Project Veritas, hoax group, very closely. They were promising a whole lot of course, huge bombshell scoops this year, Lauren, to prove all kinds of Democratic voter fraud going all over the country. But they didn't really come up with much of anything. What happened there? I'm disappointed. Any idea what went wrong?
Well, I was working pretty closely with activists, mm-hmm. Voting rights activists, good governance activists. You know, I've long been an activist in the money and politics community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you may have known that, mm-hmm. you know, several years ago when I was living in L.A. and launched The Undercurrent,
mm-hmm.
I was working with Money Out Voters In. Anyway, you know, a lot of those folks, you know, working in tables, like all these different groups collaborating to make sure that we had strong election integrity safeguards in place, mm-hmm. for the election.
Right.
And because, you know, there was a lot of communication between these groups, and I had done a lot of outreach, period, just to progressive groups over the years,
mm-hmm.
Every cycle warning about this type of thing. I had a lot of different people reach out to me from different groups to say, hey, you know, we've come across this person, it's suspicious. And so then, you know, digging into it, realizing, oh, this has all the marks of an O'Keefe operation, a Project mm-hmm. Veritas operation. So you need to take steps to safeguard, you know, your volunteers, mm-hmm. your, obviously your employees, but all of your operations. And, you know, I think because of the awareness of that threat,
mm-hmm.
Once it, people were just so much more aware and like moved into action. And I think that we're just able to snuff out any of those infiltrations before it could yield anything of value.
Yeah.
I mean, they still tried to publish things that really at the end of the day went nowhere. And O'Keefe published something last night, actually, from Georgia, trying to late in the game, I guess, like influence the Georgia election. But, you know, releasing something the night before election day is, I think, it's pretty clear to me he was grasping for straws because he had nothing all along.
Yeah, you were, and I received some of your notices, I think, over the past year or so with photographs of anyone who knows this person. Please let us know. We suspect them to be an O'Keefe operative. So maybe you inoculated them before they were able to do their worst damage by outing these people. Lauren Windsor, before I let you go, anyone, it's up to you. And I'll tell you that this show airs on a lot of our affiliates on the next day, the next morning. So some listeners may already know what happened in Georgia by the time they hear this, if depending on how close the race is. But do you want to make any predictions on the senatorial races before you go, how this is going to work out?
I predict it's going to be really close. I am very hopeful. I am a little too superstitious in this case, given how much hangs in the balance, but I would just like to say that I've never seen, I think, so much motivation and activism here in this state from people around the country and within Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really impressed. I'm really excited. I think that Democrats are going to take the Senate. I think that. Well, I say declaratively.
Yeah.
My fingers are crossed.
good call. Good pulling it back. You've learned a lot from Kelly Loeffler, it seems, on how to dodge hard questions.
Kind of both ways.
Yeah, exactly. Lauren Windsor is the executive director of American Family Voices, the executive producer of The Undercurrent, which you can see at theundercurrent.tv. You can also follow them on Facebook at The Undercurrents, and you can follow Lauren on the Twitters as it happens at LA Windsor. Lauren, great speaking with you, and stay safe out there and get home soon. You deserve a break.
Thanks so much, Brad.
Thank you. Okay, let's take a quick, speaking of deserving a break, we're running late, quick break. And we are back with more Brad, some encouraging news I think you'll like, Desi Doyen.
Oh, good.
Which I think we would all like at this point. All right, you're listening to The Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. If you haven't noticed by now, it's no easy feat finding facts, real facts, not alternative facts, over your public airwaves. We try to bring you real facts, truth, and clarity without fear or favor each and every day on the Bradcast. But we need your help to do it, and that help is needed more now than ever. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane.
Good.
Don't know when I'll be back again.
Oh, don't rush.
Oh, babe,
welcome back. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. And so, you know, we don't usually like to speculate on this program.
Yep.
But just to lighten things up a little bit today, Des, before we get to Desi Doyen's first Green News report of the new year, in which she, as usual, ruins everything, let's be speculating about Donald Trump's dark, dark future. Actually, kind of feels quite comforting today, at least to me. Speculative or not. So this story, to that end, is quite interesting along those lines. Donald Trump could be set to flee to his loss-making golf course in Scotland in a bid to avoid Joe Biden's inauguration, according to Scotland's The National.
Ooh.
Prestwick Airport, which is apparently near Trump's Turnberry golf resort in Scotland, has been told to expect the arrival of a U.S. military Boeing 757 aircraft on January 19. That, of course, is the day before his Democratic rival is expected to become president formally on Inauguration Day.
Hmm.
A source at the airport told the Sunday Post, quote, there is a booking for an American military version of the Boeing 757 on January 19. That's one that's normally used by the vice president, but often used by the first lady. Presidential flights tend to get booked far in advance because of the work that has to be done around it. And of course, you know, this is a tiny little airport that was in danger of going out of business. So, you know, for a big Boeing 757 to be landing there, that's not just normal, everyday.
Yeah. No, that's real different from what they're used to.
Airport sources said surveillance planes appeared to lay the groundwork for Trump's arrival back in November. A U.S. Air Force plane modified for the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance role had landed at Prestwick on November 12. It made a number of flights over Trump Turnberry for some reason. And another U.S. Army aircraft that visited the airport on November 12 also carried out surveillance flights over Trump Turnberry. Why? I don't know. A source said the survey aircraft was based at Prestwick for about a week. And they say, the source says, it is usually a sign Trump is going to be somewhere for an extended period. The course is currently closed because of the coronavirus pandemic. Speculation of the tycoon's visit, according to The National, to his mother's homeland. Tycoon, I don't know if that's the word I would use at this point.
Being generous.
Yes, maybe refugee on the run at that point. That comes as his flagship Turnberry course posted a loss of more than £2.3 million in 2019. I think that's about $4 million these days. Apparently, that is the sixth year in a row that it's made the loss at that course, according to the paper, which cites losses each and every single year from 2014 to 2018, from about $5 million to about $20 million in the red each and every year. Trump's other Scottish golf course at in Aberdeenshire, I don't know, made a loss of more than £1 million for the eighth consecutive year. The art of the deal.
and maybe now the art of the escape route at well, this point for him.
Well, while we're speculating wildly, I wonder if that means that he would be trying to take Air Force One, which, you know, in 24 hours after January 19th, will no longer be his to commandeer.
He's going to steal a plane? I saw that movie. Joe Biden's going to have to get on there.
That would be
get
quite
off
the screenplay.
My plane. Yeah. The UK, though, you know, recently refused to extradite Julian Assange to the U.S. So maybe that's a signal to Donald Trump that he can escape to the UK and remain safely in Scotland as all kinds of indictments are filed against him after he's no longer president. So see, I told you you would enjoy speculating on that, thinking
sure.
about the possibilities. All right, one more before we get to the disastrous Green News Report. Senator Ted Cruz and about 9 or 10 other senators joined Congress members Mo Brooks of Alabama, Jim Jordan of Ohio, and Andy Biggs of Arizona on a 50-minute phone call Monday afternoon, reportedly by Politico, to discuss their plans to challenge the Electoral College votes for President-elect Joe Biden during the joint session of Congress on Wednesday, which is usually a pro forma session to ratify the Electoral College votes. But this year, it's going to be used for a whole bunch of U.S. senators to either cement their place as a 2024 presidential contender or blow it up completely, depending on how things go.
I thought you were going to say to cement their position as 2020 coup plotters.
There's that. That's already been cemented
yeah.
at this point. So the plans, they say, are not set in stone, but apparently the senators agree to object to 3 or 4 state certifications, according to Politico's source, even though House members are pushing for 6. They would like Arizona, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nevada to be challenged. But the way this is going to work is apparently they're going to challenge Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania, and then see about the others, because this is done according to the Electoral Count Act of 1887. This is done in alphabetical order. So Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania, and then they'll decide how well things went when they get to Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nevada, apparently. There can be up to 2 hours of debate for each state, and of course the time it will take for them to walk back across the Capitol each time there is an objection filed in writing by a senator and a House member. Then they have to immediately go to their separate chambers. Then they have to have 2 hours. Then they have to have the vote. So even if there's only 3 states that they object at, this could be a very, very long day. Apparently, the senators plan to raise objections to states with, quote, constitutional deficiencies, according to a Politico source. Now, what they mean probably by constitutional deficiencies, I'm going to assume they're referring to their claim that only state legislatures may set rules for elections as per the Constitution's Electors and Elections Clause. This claim has made its way into a number of the now 62 Team Trump lawsuits following the election, which have all been rejected or dropped or dismissed, often by Trump-appointed federal judges. I believe I noted yesterday on the program that one case that was tossed out just yesterday that was filed by the right-wing Thomas More Society, the court found that the challenge was deficient based on what Brad Blog legal analyst Ernie Canning described to me as a blatantly erroneous reading of a single line in Article 2 of the Constitution. That's the Elections Clause, which reads, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. But as the court noted, plaintiffs somehow interpreted this straightforward passage to mean that state legislatures alone must certify presidential votes and presidential electors. As a result, the court wrote, state statutes that delegate the certification to the Secretary of State or the governor or anywhere else is invalid, according to what the Republicans were arguing. The court on Monday tossed that out. They said that if they were to follow that reasoning, then the Supreme Court's decisions in Bush v. Gore back in 2000 and Texas versus Pennsylvania in December, which was thrown out by the U.S. Supreme Court, that those would be decisions in constitutional error, according to this court, who threw out, I think it was, I don't know if we're up to 60, 61, 62 as of today, that was thrown out. So they're going to wait and see how that goes with the first three states. It's going to be a very, very long day. By the way, it's all supposed to happen on one single day. However, Politico sources say that apparently there is a rule that allows for recesses to occur, so they could go overnight. This could take more than one day.
Oi.
I know, oi. Congressional Democrats, for their part, have also been strategizing about what to do for Wednesday's lengthy session. Apparently, House Democrats, they held a caucus call on Monday with Nancy Pelosi, urging members to be dignified throughout the entire long process and basically let the Republicans eat each other alive.
Indeed.
During this mess. All right, quick break, and we're back with the Green News Report,
Yay!
The first one of the year. Right after this, I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
So, Desi Doyen, did we miss a lot of green news while we were off for the past week?
So much. This is only a small portion.
You weren't able to jam everything into the 6 minutes?
Sadly, no.
You do a hell of a job trying in our latest green news report.
Believe me, it will find an ignition source pretty darn readily.
On way out the door, Trump Transportation Department approves bomb trains. Trump EPA's parting gifts include more asthma attacks and deaths from air pollution. Plus, Japan unveils ambitious national plan to achieve net zero emissions by 2050.
Why can't America be as great as everywhere else in the world? All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It's almost like Trump is trying to be the worst president for every species.
Success! I knew he'd get something right after 4 years. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I'm sure everything now that we're in 2021 is way, way better than it was in 2020.
Surprise! Not so much.
Oh, great.
On New Year's Day, outgoing President Donald Trump vetoed bipartisan...
Who?
Outgoing President Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah. I just like hearing it. Continue.
Yeah, Trump vetoed bipartisan legislation that would have phased out the use of massive commercial fishing drift nets in federal waters off the coast of California that indiscriminately killed dozens of marine species like whales and dolphins. The Trump administration also reversed long-standing federal policy and approved the transport of volatile, highly flammable liquefied natural gas by rail anywhere in the country, including through densely populated areas and within feet of homes and schools, with no public oversight and over the objections of 15 states.
These are those so-called bomb trains that we have seen. Has been a while, but we have seen them blowing up all over the country.
Indeed. But this would be natural gas. And of course, it hasn't been a while. It's been only 2 weeks since an oil train derailed and exploded, causing a fire north of Seattle about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, there's that.
In another parting gift, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency has refused to tighten air quality standards for dangerous ozone, the main ingredient in toxic smog, meaning more children will get asthma and more people will die prematurely from air pollution. One health expert compared inhaling ozone to, quote, getting a bad sunburn on your lungs. Failing to tighten ozone standards, however, does provide marginal profits to oil and coal companies.
Because, of course, it does.
And in its most consequential rollback, the Trump EPA has finalized a rule that restricts the scientific data that EPA scientists are allowed to use when crafting rules to protect public health. The Trump EPA's Orwellian transparency rule actually blocks the use of studies in which the data is either proprietary or researchers have not disclosed confidential patient medical records. Such data had previously been used for landmark regulations restricting air pollution and pesticides, but no data, no rule. A former director of the agency's science advisory board told the Washington Post, quote, "This is a bold attempt to get science out of the way so special interests can do what they want."
Amazing how much damage he can do with just 2 weeks left.
The EPA's refusal to tighten pollution standards for ozone and other contaminants is a direct consequence of the Trump administration short-circuiting established federal scientific review procedures. It will take years for the Biden administration to complete the process of repairing the damage that Trump has done. But there is one positive change, sort of. The EPA finally updated the federal lead and copper rule for the first time since 1991, aimed at reducing toxic lead in drinking water, which causes brain damage in children. Health experts welcomed many provisions in the rule, but they said it omits the most important step to get the lead out. It does not require the removal of the estimated 6 million lead service lines still remaining across the country, allowing them to remain in service for decades to come.
So I was going to ask why, oh, why they would possibly do something good. And I guess there's your answer. If they do this part of it, they can block the other part of it for a long time.
Yes. However, there is some justice for residents of Flint, Michigan. More than 6 years after the city's drinking water was contaminated with toxic lead in a wide-ranging, shocking scandal, Michigan's Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer has signed a $640 million settlement to compensate residents and establish the strictest lead and copper water quality standards in the nation. And finally, Japan has announced an ambitious green growth plan targeting net zero carbon emissions by 2050. The Japanese government's plan establishes roadmaps for the nation's different industrial sectors to achieve the net zero goal. It includes funding that will triple renewables in the country's energy mix and includes the phase out of conventional gasoline-powered vehicles within 15 years.
See, it's not all bad. Don't be such a crybaby. 2021 is looking up already. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I've got to admit, it's getting better.
That line, it can't get no worse.
Yeah, that's, let's hope it doesn't get any worse.
Let's hope that's right. All right, thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks also to my guest today, The Undercurrents, Lauren Windsor, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com or your favorite podcast site. Though we do ask those of you we thank those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate for keeping us up and rolling still, even into 2021. We couldn't do it without you. Those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate, thank you. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am TheBradBlog. We will see you there until we see you here next time, maybe with results coming out of Georgia. We'll see. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Yeah.